They say those who don't learn from environmental history are doomed to repeat it. I'm Kara Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we combed through our archives for history lessons from industrial disasters.
These folks gave their lives so that we can have clean air.
To misguided infrastructure projects.
The respect for the power of nature, people really didn't think about that when they were making all of these changes.
We'll also hear about voices that didn't often make it into history books.
African Americans turned to green spaces in order to gather together and also to agitate.
Those and more environmental history stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. In 1948, the world was shocked when smog killed at least 20 people and sickened thousands in a small town in western Pennsylvania. Decades later, townspeople want everyone to remember this environmental disaster and the good that has come from their great loss. A few years ago, the Allegheny Front's Anne Murray visited the Denora Smog Museum when it first opened. Here's her story.
Don Pavelko is pleased to have an audience for the town's most compelling tale. 11-year-old Dakota Johnston has wandered into his small storefront museum in Denora, Pennsylvania. Hundreds of images and artifacts line the museum's walls. Pavelko begins with an old aerial photograph of Denora.
See where all that smoke is right there?
Yeah.
That was the zinc works. That was the main culprit.
The toxic smoke from that zinc plant was the culprit in a 1948 disaster that claimed 20 lives and made thousands of people sick in tiny Denora. Pavelko, a town councilman, was born 8 years later. He says growing up, nobody talked about what happened when a thick yellow smog hung over the valley for 5 straight days and left the town with a trail of bodies.
It was sort of a black eye to Denora, and I always heard, let it die, let it die.
But Pavelko and some other townspeople want the world to remember. They recently opened the Denora Smog Museum because they believe something positive came out of this tragedy. To make the case, Pavelko walks outside. The sun glistens off a flaming orange sign that reads, "Clean air started here."
We here in Denora say that this episode was the beginning of the environmental movement. These folks gave their lives so that we can have clean air.
The Denora smog tragedy, the worst environmental air pollution disaster in U.S. history, let the public know that industrial pollution could kill. It eventually led to the Clean Air Act. Before that, people in mill towns like Denora lived under blankets of dirty air. A photograph in the window of the museum shows mourners at the gravesite of one of the victims of the smog. Smoke from the zinc plant and steel mill continues to plume above them. Charles Stacy, who spent the past year assembling old newspaper clippings and maps for the Smog Museum, remembers the time when scenes like these weren't ironic.
Many times we walked to school and could barely see where we were going. We just thought that that was a normal way of life.
Developing countries, says Dever Davis, still have lessons to learn from Denora. Davis, an epidemiologist, grew up in Denora and was 2 when the killer smog hit. She's the author of When Smoke Ran Like Water, a National Book Award finalist about Denora and other industrial disasters.
When I gave my first talk about this internationally, 2 young colleagues came up to me, one from China and one from Mexico. They said, "We have Denoras happening now in China and Mexico. If people understand that this happened to you, then we will be able to do better to help our people."
Don Pavelko is proud of his town's legacy. Back inside the museum, he shows Dakota Johnston an old oxygen tank. The same tank a firefighter carried through the dark streets of Denora to help citizens survive the smog that put pollution control on the map.
That's why today you got clean air. You might have to worry about a few other things, but you don't have to worry about polluted air like you did back then.
That's good.
For the Allegheny Front, this is Anne Murray. We'll be right back.
Events like the tragedy in Denora have inspired some to take on the long history of air pollution in Pennsylvania's industrial cities. Among those activists is the Group Against Smog and Pollution, or GASP. Today, they tackle issues in Pittsburgh from school bus idling to power plant permits. But the group formed in 1969 during a significant push to clean up the air over America's cities, which was especially bad in Pittsburgh. So bad that Voice of America broadcast a radio documentary about it in 1970.
You'd go to town with a pair of white gloves, and you'd come home with a dirty face and dirty gloves.
That's Mrs. Martha Pendleton, a retired schoolteacher and longtime Pittsburgh resident.
The special highlighted efforts by a group of housewives, doctors, and engineers to clean up the city's air pollution. Back then, GASP was led by its first president, Michelle Madoff.
And we represent the little man. This, we want anybody with lungs. I don't know where you can buy new lungs.
Well, I think that in Pittsburgh, everyone knew and understand about environmental impact because you could literally taste it.
Jim Longhurst is a professor of environmental history at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He wrote a book about GASP. During an interview he recorded with Michelle Madoff, she explained how the group formed after an initial meeting in her home.
There were about 30 people, and we needed a name. And somebody said, there's a group called the Group Against Smelters Pollution. And they said, why don't we adopt it? I was out of the room. And we'll call ourselves Group Against Smog and Pollution. And that's what they did. And I became president.
Longhurst says the group was one of many that formed in the late 60s and 70s to address pollution. And like GASP, they had short, catchy names.
There's COPE, CARP, GASP, CHOKE, CAP, and CAN. And a lot of them start with a C because they start with the word citizen.
GASP had a knack for marketing. In one successful campaign, the group sold cans of clean air.
And the papers carried it because it's a visual and it's a news story. People don't understand this is how you get your information out. And I had to go to the dentist that day. And when I got out, I turned on my car radio, and I was driving by then. And the car said, they said, Commissioner Hunt called Michelle Madoff a paranoid asthmatic with a fetish for air. I still have it in my wallet. A paranoid asthmatic with a fetish for air. Isn't that marvelous?
Longhurst says Madoff and GASP were instrumental in improving Pittsburgh's air quality at a time when there was a new sense of urgency in the country to do something about it. People felt empowered by new federal air regulations.
Before this point in time, there were agreements about controlling air pollution in Pittsburgh, but those were generally what we call gentlemen's agreement. They are arrived at behind closed doors. GASP pushed their way into those meetings and those debates.
Michelle Madoff would go on to be a city councilwoman in Pittsburgh. She passed away in 2013 at the age of 85. But part of her legacy is that concern for air quality is mainstream in Pittsburgh, and GASP lives on. You can see a cartoon of Dirty Gertie that was part of another early GASP marketing campaign. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. In the early 1800s, Pennsylvania was in a hurry to ship goods across the state with one of its most abundant natural resources. Water.
Technology maybe wasn't quite ready yet, but they made it work because nobody wanted to be left behind.
And it did work, sort of. Coming up on the Allegheny Front, the short history of Pennsylvania's canal system. Stay tuned. You wouldn't know it because of all the attention on corporate energy companies fracking the Marcellus Shale for natural gas in Pennsylvania, but there are still thousands of mom-and-pop pumpers scattered throughout the state pulling oil from the ground the same way they have for 100 years. Caitlin Farrell has their story.
This 140-year-old oil well stands in the middle of a McDonald's drive-thru in Bradford, Pennsylvania.
Welcome to McDonald's.
It's a working remnant of a time when the state was a petroleum powerhouse.
Can I have a grilled chicken snap?
While people call out orders for burgers and fries, most don't even notice the pump jack pulling oil from the ground beneath them. This well is one of thousands drilled during Pennsylvania's oil boom in the 1860s and 70s. It's producing Pennsylvania-grade crude. It's not like black motor oil. It's clear and waxy. Pennsylvania crude is used to make cosmetics and pharmaceuticals, to varnish wood and moisturize hair. And Mark Klein is proud of it.
That's beautiful oil right there.
He's president of the Pennsylvania Independent Oil Producers, and he owns the well.
The city tried to get us to get it out of here. McDonald's tried to get it out of here. I was thinking the other day I should have it registered as a historic site.
Pennsylvania's shale gas and hydraulic fracturing boom, driven by corporations, has eclipsed much of what small, independent oil producers first built here in the 19th century. But some of those old-time producers are hanging on. More than 5,000 still strip oil from straight, vertical wells using a complex system of engines and pumps. It's the same technique Tom Miller's father and grandfather used for decades.
When I was 16 years old, I worked on a drilling rig on a 4-to-midnight shift in the summertime. And that was because I wanted to learn how to do it.
For Miller, like many who are keeping this legacy industry alive, it's a culture around which they've built their lives. Miller walks me through his warehouse of antique engines, showing them off like the pages of an old family photo album. He knows how each was made, when it was used, and it's personal to him. As we come to a shiny, dark green engine sitting on a wood pallet, he tears up.
But this was the first engine I ever started. It was my dad's.
Each year, dozens of independent oil producers gather for a picnic in Titusville, Pennsylvania. This is a special place for them. It's where Edwin Drake drilled the first successful oil well in 1859. Mark Klein, he's the guy that owns that well at the McDonald's, calls this old machinery the music of an era that's fading. It's remarkable they've survived this long, according to Brian Black. He's a professor of history and environmental studies at Penn State Altoona, and author of several books on Pennsylvania's petroleum industry.
You could say very clearly that for the last probably 150 years, the independents have been a dying breed. And certainly over the last 50 years, they have been a dying breed.
Mark Klein faces that every day. After he finishes pumping at the McDonald's well, he heads down the road to his family's oldest. It was drilled all the way back in 1880, and still produces 3/4 of a barrel of bubbly, yellowed Pennsylvania crude every day.
You'd think it would all be gone, and it's just there day after day after day.
Klein's thankful that there's still Pennsylvania crude underground, and thousands of people still dedicated to pumping it. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Caitlin Farrell.
Since that story aired in 2015, the state of Pennsylvania has exempted these smaller oil producers from new rules for the big wells in the Marcellus and Utica shales. The state has formed a new committee, the Penn Grade Crude Development Advisory Council, to help create rules for these small, independently owned wells. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. When author Diane Glave told her graduate studies advisor that she wanted to write a broad thesis on African-American environmental history, she was told the project was too ambitious. She didn't listen. And a PhD later, her book, Rooted in the Earth, Reclaiming the African-American Environmental Heritage, was born. A couple of summers ago, I sat down with Glave at a church in Pittsburgh where she'd been serving as a pastor to talk about some of the themes in the book. Thank you so much for talking with me.
I am so glad to be here with you.
You've written a book about African-American environmental history, but tell me a little bit about your history. How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, it goes back actually to childhood. My grandparents, I would go and visit them in Jamaica, and they had a farm. And so that was one of my most visceral experiences of nature very early on. When maybe I was 5 or 6 years old, I remember a little fish in a cistern where rainwater was collected, and that was basically the water that we bathed in and drank. Just sort of visualized Jamaica, this beautiful place, and opportunities to go to the ocean. I mean, it's not like where I grew up, Queens, where it was a different sort of ocean. It was green and it was blue, it was emerald green. My parents also impacted me in terms of nature. They used to take my brother and I to a place called Baker's Camp. We would have free reign of an area in upstate New York, and my parents would set us loose all day long, and we would return for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but basically we were on our own. And everybody, you know, felt that we were safe, and I felt safe and comfortable.
They're fictional characters. They begin each of the chapters of your book, which is somewhat unusual for a work of nonfiction. Why did you decide to use that storytelling device for talking about environmental history?
Well, I'm a little biased because I have a BA in creative writing, so I don't know if I woke up one morning and I was like, oh, I had a dream and I'm going to, you know, use fictional characters. But I also thought that it would draw people in to sort of flesh out the history.
Some of the characters start in the 1700s, 1800s, and some of them are more modern day.
Yes, that's true. And it almost felt like a journey that I was taking with my own family. I mean, these things didn't happen to my family. But I got so engrossed in what I was learning that they became very familiar to me.
Well, one of the characters is on a ship, like a merchant ship. It has to do with slavery, and some of it has to do with African-Americans in this sort of economy.
Yeah. This particular character was, to me, very complex because he had the experience of traveling from place to place in working on a ship. And he wasn't an equal with the whites that were on the ship. But he found ways to have really profound experiences on the ocean. You know, because he wasn't in control of where he was going, he went to cold places in the Northeast, and he was in the Caribbean. He was also a conduit. I mean, I think I talk a little bit about how the folks that were on these ships, especially African Americans, they were almost like an old school internet. It was slower than our internet, but they were the ones that were traveling around and saying, this is what's happening in England. This is what's happening in Maine. And they were moving around and sharing this information with people. So they used the ocean and they used their contacts as a means of communicating and spreading the information out to other African Americans, other Africans that didn't have the same ability.
All of the characters are in some way related to a natural aspect, whether it's the ocean or water or woodland or farmland. But one of the main points in your book is that there is this myth that African Americans are separate or separate themselves from the environment or the natural world. What are the roots of that myth?
I think some of the mythology is true. I think the roots are in the fact that Africans were pulled from their home in Africa, their own environment, and they were forced onto ships in the Middle Passage. And then they came here to the Americas, which included the Caribbean and the Northeast and the Southeast. And they were forced to labor on the land. So most were, you know, they were doing it to survive, but they didn't connect in that way. I also think that the mythology is wrong because of the roots that come out of Africa and the expertise that Africans brought to the Americas, including rice production. They were telling the slaveholders how to do the rice production because they brought it from Africa.
Your book goes into this very deep history of how some African Americans in the past have been afraid or have negative feelings about nature, not just agricultural history of the plantation South and enslavement, but from the ocean and the woods. But this comes out of the history of enslavement and forced labor. Can you say a little bit more about that?
I remember when I worked at a university down in Louisiana, and a gentleman, he was white, he asked me to step in with a family. He wanted to take some children out into the ocean, into the Gulf. And the mother, African-American mother, refused to send her son, and he wanted me to arbitrate this situation and kind of push her to let the son go out into the ocean. And I said to him, I'm not going to do that because the history of Africans and African-Americans in a place like Louisiana goes deep. It's a little bit more shallow in other places because they've retained their Africanisms. And there may be a story that goes all the way back to the Middle Passage in which, you know, ancestors were brutalized and they went through a horrible experience. And in some ways, even in a small way, it's been retained from generation to generation, the fear of water. In the context of the woods, where Africans who were enslaved, they were tracked in the woods. And you had whites and perhaps other blacks working for the whites, tracking them down with dogs. So it wasn't always synonymous with being a safe place.
So you're a pastor, you have a religious role. What about spirituality and religion as it relates to the environment in history and during the times of enslavement or afterwards or even before?
there was a tension that evolved between whites and blacks, especially during enslavement. And in order for Africans and African Americans to meet at all, they went to places called brush harbors where they went to worship, and they went into the woods to have conversations, because slaveholders and even folks, even whites in the late 19th and early 20th century, they had black codes. They did not want blacks gathering together because they were concerned that there would be revolt and that there would be violence. So African Americans turned to green spaces in order to gather together and also to agitate.
And also, we talked a little bit about the fear that some African Americans may have of wooded or wild places, but there was also that hope of escape, that the woods or wild places would lead to freedom.
Oh, definitely. That's the flip side. Africans, those who were enslaved, really, many of them knew the land outside of the plantation. I mean, they knew the pathways, they knew the trees, they knew what was poisonous, what wasn't, and they developed the skill and the ability, and some of it they drew from Africa, to live off the land for extended periods of time. And I'm thinking about, I think they're called Maroons in Jamaica. They went deep into the Caribbean landscape, hiding from the British, and they did that permanently. And the British weren't able to track them down because they didn't know the land as intimately as those Jamaicans who had fled the plantations.
The second part of the title of your book, Rooted in the Earth, is reclaiming the African American environmental heritage. How can people do that?
I think there's so many ways. I think that I'm a, I don't know if I'd say I was reclaiming, but last summer I went to my first national park. I encountered one African American or an African when I was in Montana at Glacier National Park. I can't tell you what a profound experience it was to actually see a glacier before they're gone. And I know for me that spiritually and mentally, I'm better when I'm outdoors. You know, I remember when I was living in New Orleans, people would sit on their stoop or they'd sit on their porch in front of their houses. And there was a banana tree behind the double shotgun that I was living in. And I would just go and sit there, and just that little tree would soothe me. So I don't think that people need to spend the kind of money. If you can afford it, that's great. But you don't need to spend that kind of money. It's right there with you.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here with you. I appreciate it.
Diane Glave is the author of Rooted in the Earth, Reclaiming the African American Environmental Heritage. She's also the coordinator of diversity development for the United Methodist Center here in southwestern Pennsylvania. For more on her work, check out our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
This week on the Trump on Earth podcast, what's it like to be a reporter covering Donald Trump's EPA?
I guess having a sharp eye for the different shades of climate change denial is more relevant than ever.
Rating Trump's first 2 months. That's this week on the Trump on Earth podcast from the Allegheny Front and Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. Listen on iTunes or TrumpOnEarth.org.
Say revolutionary technology, and maybe smartphones come to mind, or Facebook. But long before Mark Zuckerberg, canals were the big disruptors. They redrew the wilderness and remade the country's economy. In Pennsylvania, a great example of that transition is a National Park Service site in Blair County. Margaret J. Krause visited the Allegheny Portage Railroad and has this unlikely story of how canals helped create a gateway to the West.
Park Ranger Doug Bosley says he still kind of can't believe that Pennsylvania pulled it off.
Nothing about this was easy.
Bosley is showing me a stretch of track that runs uphill at a pretty steep slope for a railroad, a 6 or 7% grade. It was one of a series of tracks called the Allegheny Portage Railroad that stepped its way over Allegheny Mountain. It wasn't a huge hill, but at the time, it took some doing.
The locomotives weren't very powerful. A lot of them were only 20 to 30 horsepower. Your lawn tractor at home, more powerful than the locomotives at that time.
We're standing at the crest of what's now a quiet green hillside. But the Allegheny Portage Railroad National Historic Site was once part of a short-lived, revolutionary system that transformed Pennsylvania forever. Here's how it happened. The 1820s was a time of national expansion, fueled by American chutzpah.
Sort of the, you know, the age of Jackson, you know, the President Andrew Jackson, and sort of the everyman age. Everybody can rise up, you know, no matter what station you started out in life. That was the can-do attitude.
As the U.S. border edged westward, there were greater opportunities to move raw materials such as timber from the west to the east and finished products back in the other direction.
But there was no practical way to do it.
That is, until the Erie Canal opened in New York in 1825. While it took 3 to 4 weeks to ship goods on pack animals west across Pennsylvania, it took just 10 days to send them on the Erie Canal. New York boomed, and Pennsylvania didn't want to lose out.
Technology maybe wasn't quite ready yet, but they made it work because nobody wanted to be left behind.
Enter the Pennsylvania Main Line of Public Works. That was the very formal name for a system of canals funded by the state to connect Philadelphia to Pittsburgh and on to points west. It was nearly 400 miles of inland waterways, with the exception of this 36-mile Allegheny Portage Railroad.
The surveyors came through, staked out the line where the railroad would be, and then the first work that was done was cutting a 120-foot-wide swath through the forest.
When the main line opened for business in 1834, it was like the Amazon.com of the 19th century. Suddenly, everyday people could afford to buy the things they needed and get them in a timely fashion. But these modern conveniences came at a cost. The most notorious instance of this was making the canal reservoir outside Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Turns out, one of the biggest problems of running a canal system is keeping enough water in there so boats can run even in dry seasons. So the mainline system dammed South Fork Creek to create the reservoir. It failed. Big. When it broke in 1889, the flood killed 2,209 people.
The respect for the power of nature and how man was changing the landscape, people really didn't think about that when they were making all of these changes.
Louis Quett is a hydraulic engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I spoke with him in his office in downtown Pittsburgh. He spends his days controlling water flow in local rivers, and he says the canal system of the 1830s continues to inform river traffic today.
It is folly for us to believe that we can control nature. But it is certainly reasonable for humans to work with nature.
Today, few sections of the mainline survive, and none are used commercially. About 20 years after it was completed, the Pennsylvania Railroad purchased the whole system. While the canals may be gone, water is still how we move a lot of goods from point A to point B. Things like coal, farm produce, and petroleum products ply the inland waterways through the Army Corps' river system of locks and dams, which kicked off in the late 1800s.
We don't see an end to river navigation. You know, our roads are certainly already crowded, and a single standard barge holds as much cargo as 15 railroad cars or 60 semi-trucks.
So Quett says, leveraging the power of water might be an old idea, but it's one that still works in the 21st century. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
Thanks for listening to this week's show and joining us for a look into our region's environmental history. As always, there's more at AlleghenyFront.org. And now that we're in the 21st century, we're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.